Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, catching up on our sleep news and research with Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. So good to see you back in our studio. Dr. Dykin, just a few days away from the winter solstice. We'll have a few words about that. We'll ask you for a little advice later in the program. Welcome.
Yeah, good to see you too.
We're going to look into research as we do all this time. We want to ask you as well, how is your sleep? Share your sleep problem, or perhaps you have a solution, a remedy for a long-standing sleep problem that you have solved that you'd like to share so we can all learn. Perhaps you just have an unusual sleep experience that has puzzled you, or a sleep experience of a family member. Get some advice from Dr. Dykin. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Later in the hour, we'll talk about what is being proclaimed. His or her or its name is Somnox, the world's first self-proclaimed sleep robot. And also the connection between THC in cannabis, how that may treating so many different disorders, perhaps also apnea. We'll hear about a new study on that. A nap deprivation study, a study of people who love to take naps and then were deprived of naps to find out some things. Also, the best and worst sleep studies, sleep cities in the U.S., excuse me, the best cities in the U.S. to sleep and the worst ones. Are any of those Iowans on there? We'll find out a little later in this program. First, Dr. Dykin, I wanted to ask you about a study that was outlined this morning by John Hamilton from NPR on Morning Edition, a study that really gets at the longstanding question about how aging can affect memory, even in people who do not have sort of Alzheimer's symptoms or other brain diseases. This is a study that looked at older adults' forgetfulness tied to brain rhythms in sleep. What did they look at here?
Well, there are certain brain waves as we get older that tend to decrease, and these are slow waves. They're about 2 cycles per second. So if you look at all the little squiggly lines on those brain waves that you see on TV, movies, lie detector tests, stuff like that, they're very slow waves, and they are associated with what we call slow wave or N3 sleep. And as we get older, we get less and less of the slow wave sleep. Now, what they looked at was the synchronization, simultaneous occurrence of this slow wave, very high amplitude, slow discharge from the brain with another waveform called a sleep spindle. Now, sleep spindles are traditionally seen in a different stage of sleep, a N2 sleep, not slow wave sleep, N3 sleep. But on occasion, you can see spindles in slow wave sleep. And in this study, when they saw a slow wave occurring simultaneously with a spindle, it tended to associate with better memory. So they looked at a lot of youngsters, 20 young people, and their memory was tremendous for these tasks that they gave them after a full night of sleep, a lot of pairing of the slow waves and the spindles, and the next day they did really great on the memory on this task they were given the day before. Then they took old people like me and someday like you, 60 to 70 years of age. Now, my group did not have a very good synchronization, a one-to-one occurrence between the slow wave and the spindle. And it may have been off just a 50 milliseconds or so, but they believe that paralleled our poor performance on the same memory task. So the next day, the worse we did on synchronization, the worse we did on memory. So their thought was, if we could prevent this from happening, wouldn't that be great? And they see that the parts of the brain in their mind that tend to atrophy as we get older are associated with the slow wave sleep. Although that's a bit of speculation because there's a lot of parts of the brains.
When you talk about waves, how many different waves are electromagnetic? What?
Discharges from the cells of the brain, the neurons.
That's a brain wave. And we have how many different types?
Well, in sleep, we have four major different sleep stages that are defined by brain waves. And then we have waking brain waves. In waking, we have an alpha discharge, about 8 to 10 cycles per second discharge. When we go into N1 sleep, we have specific vertex discharges or waves. When we go into deeper sleep, N2, we have spindles, waveforms, that are about 11 to 16 cycles per second, in addition to K complexes. And then when we get into slow wave sleep, we have those slow, high amplitude, 0.5 to about 2 cycle per second, real slow discharges from our brain neurons.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them.
Yeah, and so the idea here, too, is that the more we're learning about deep stages of sleep, this is what we think is a consolidation of memory. So if that little two-step dance that these two waves are doing is slightly out of sync on your brain's dance floor, it's not consolidating, it's not functioning. This is the thought.
That's their hypothesis, and they relate it to atrophy, normal atrophy of certain parts of the brain. So they said, well, if we could stimulate the discharge, which is the real problem. How do you stimulate those discharges electrically or electromagnetically? So we have magnetic stimulation of the brain that we can do, electrical stimulation of the brain, and you sort of wonder how you could focus a stimulation of the brain to get those discharges. Because they said if you could do that, maybe you could prevent the atrophy of the brain with age or Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. And just I think in the report they used, the next step would be sort of to make a functioning sort of metronome for these waves so that they know what the pace is and how to sync up.
But how would you do that? You know, and it's funny, you and I had talked about this. As I got older, I started running slower, and my muscles started to atrophy as compared to when I was 16. If I could just get electrical stimulation of my muscles all the time or in certain stages of sleep, I may be an Olympic runner forever. Is that the reason the brain is atrophying? Because there's a lack of this coordination between slow wave and spindle sleep, or is it an epiphenomena that the brain is degenerating anyway? And I got to tell you, I am degenerating anyway. I mean, it doesn't matter how much I practice. I have less muscle. I'm slower than I ever was, but I'm happy.
Okay.
And it may be an epiphenomena. So we don't want to get...
An epiphenomena means something that we can't solve there.
Yeah, because your brain atrophied. You don't have the discharges. But if you had the discharges, would your brain not atrophy? Not necessarily.
Okay.
Me lifting weights all the time is going to mean me, Eric Schwarzenegger. But you don't know it. A great start to early research.
Okay. Dr. Eric Dykin is with us. If you just joined it, we're catching up on our sleep news and research. Dr. Dykin of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center, the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, neurologist, commenting on a study that was just reported on this morning on a morning edition. A team from UC Berkeley, I think, behind that study. Before we go on to some more sleep news for you to give your observations about, let's go to this email from Matt listening in Des Moines. Hi, Matt. And Matt writes, I'm 55 and I've been trying to regain a long night's sleep ever since my sleep crashed with a bout of insomnia 5 years ago. I no longer have the insomnia and have significantly improved my sleep with a whole food, plant-based diet and good sleep hygiene. I have noticed that when I eat meals that give me close to 1,000 milligrams of calcium, no supplements, he says, in a day, 1,000 milligrams of calcium through these good foods, that, he says, I sleep through the night without waking until morning. Vitamin D supplements have also helped with my good sleep, too. Are calcium and vitamin D important for good sleep, asks Matt in Des Moines.
Oh, yeah, and all your vitamins and good nutrition are important for good sleep. And as you've also added, you also have good sleep hygiene. Common sense things, you know, 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night, that's good for your health. Good exercise, good diet, the judicious use of vitamins, because you can overdo anything. You know, you don't want to overdo things. But you have, Matt has a focused plan based on good diet and sleep hygiene and practice. It makes common sense. It is patient, heal thyself. And we call it cognitive behavioral therapeutic intervention, which even the University of Iowa offers to all staff members, including Ben Kiefer.
By sleep hygiene, now let's just do a quick list of that. That means sort of your bedroom, your bed is a sacred place. You don't bring electronic devices in there. Some other parts of sleep hygiene, no big fatty food meals before you go to bed, right? Leave that pepperoni pizza for another day, right?
Common sense.
Other attributes of sleep hygiene.
Progressive relaxation therapy, the stimulus control, the great environment, the right temperature, not using the bedroom for anything other than sleep or sex. That's the classic verbiage from Dr. Bill Dement from Stanford. So common sense things.
So could that diet, that 1,000 milligrams of calcium through whole food, plant-based diet, could that have something to do with it? He also said he improved his sleep hygiene.
Could be. And my thought is, so I wouldn't argue with it.
If it works, Matt, do it.
Yeah, it is working for him, and I am not going to doubt. I know for singers, they often recommend certain levels of calcium and other vitamins. So, you know, there are thousands of years of vitamin and herbal medication uses that work for some people, but what Matt's talked about is common sense.
Okay, let's go to this bit of research. Of course, we know sleep apnea. This is the potentially serious sleep disorder. In fact, it's been linked with death. You've done research about this specific disorder at the University of Iowa. Breathing repeatedly stops and starts abnormally, affecting one in five American adults. No drugs currently available, according to the report I have, to treat it. But this large-scale clinical trial now offers some hope. A drug that uses a synthetic version of the main psychoactive substance in cannabis, this would be THC, effective for treating this disorder. Tell us about the study that you've read about.
Well, it's real interesting. And again, another one of my buddies, Phyllis C. from out at Northwestern, has been involved with this. And they had noticed in animal studies that animals, rodents, that were bred to have central sleep apnea, they stop breathing when they go to sleep, improved on this medication, on this substance. They also did a small study of, I think it was 17 people with sleep apnea, and they found that their apnea-hypopnea indexes, the number of times they stopped breathing per hour, markedly improved. Didn't go away, but improved. So what this medicine is, this drug is dronabinol, which again, as you said, is a synthetic version of THC. And they found that this drug, what it actually does is it actually blocks the effects of normal sleep. So when you and I go to sleep, our muscles relax and we don't breathe in as deep. That's just normal. And our oxygen drops a little bit. In a person with apnea, when your muscles relax too much, including the ones in the back of your throat, they get floppy and you suck in. It's like a wet straw. You get sleep apnea. Now, this effect, they really focused on what we call the vagus nerve. It has receptors for cannabinoid type 1. So you can name a receptor anything you want. But this vagal effect is actually blocked by this medication. It is an agonist. It will not let that sleepiness, that over-relaxation of the throat
occur. So your throat, because of this, the thought here is it doesn't relax into that completely floppy state that causes
I am oversimplifying the hypothesis. It's my hypothesis. So they believe that that's one of the effects and that you continue to breathe deep. And one of the things that this nerve can do, if it's really active, it reduces the tendency for automatic breathing. It will block that. So you breathe deeper, if you will, and more regularly. So I think what they actually said is that it will allow you to stabilize your respiratory pattern generation. You will continue to generate normal breathing, and it increases activation of your upper airway musculature.
Dr. Eric Dykin was with us. If you've just joined us, we're catching up on our sleep news and research. We like to do this three or four times a year with Dr. Dykin. He's a neurologist, also director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're inviting you this hour to tell us how your sleep is. Share your sleep problem, perhaps someone in your family with a sleep problem, a solution. We just had from Matt in Des Moines a suggested solution. You know, you can't go wrong with a whole food plant-based diet, good sleep hygiene. Congratulations on changing for the better there, Matt. But perhaps you have a sleep problem that hasn't been solved and you'd like some advice from Dr. Daikin. 1-866-780-9100. He's with us the entire hour. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to KP in Des Moines. Hi, KP.
My husband wears a CPAP at night, but he'll sleep always 10 hours and sometimes, and a lot of times, 12 hours a night. And I heard on your intro that that is inherited, the 12 hours.
Okay, we haven't got to that bit of research, but we can bring it in now that, you know, that describe what this is. It says so that, you know, when some people say, oh, you're just being lazy, well, it could be in your genes, Dr. Daikin?
Could be in the genes. But the question for your husband, so he's obstructive apnea, he's on a continuous positive airway pressure therapy. I use that because I have sleep apnea. Access a stent keeps your airway open. Is he sleepy during the day?
He complains that he wakes up and he'll complain that he's still sleepy.
So there are two different things. You can have genes, and that would have been the way he was since he came out of the womb. A guy who slept over 10 or 11 hours every single 24-hour period, and we call that idiopathic hypersomnia, people that are born that way. We also have short sleepers. Their entire life, they've, simplistically speaking, they've slept 3 to 5 hours per night. That's normal for them. But to be sleepy during the day, that's not what some of these people are. They may be short sleepers, long sleepers. If you have sleep apnea and you have persistent sleepiness afterwards, there is a phenomenon that we call, you know, persistent daytime sleepiness despite successful treatment of obstructive apnea. And there's a theory that microscopic damage might have been done because of the low oxygen from untreated apnea for many years to sleep-wake centers in the brain. And as such, some people with persistent sleepiness are then candidates for a medication called modafinil. So that is a phenomenon in and of itself. So to differentiate the two, a short sleeper and a longer sleeper really shouldn't be sleepy during the day. The other thing that can happen with sleep apnea, now my machine gives me a download every day, and it tells me how many apneas I have. Maybe he could be undertreated or a variety of other things. So we don't want to just, and again, talk to your primary care physician, nurse practitioner, PAMA, backbone of medicine out there in the United States. There may be more going on than just his genes, and he was born as a short or long sleeper, which some people are, but he shouldn't be sleepy during the day.
Mm. KP, does that help you at all to proceed to help your husband get a more wakeful day?
Well, he's not always sleepy during the day, not every day, not at all.
When you say he sleeps 12 hours with the CPAP machine, does he report also that he's actually asleep most of that time?
I don't know. He's sleeping. I don't know what you mean.
Well, when he has the mask on, does he report that the majority of that time, the majority of those 12 hours, he is asleep? Does he report that?
Yes.
He does. Okay. That would be a question too, wouldn't it, Dr. Dyke?
Yeah, because, and again, even for a long sleeper, 12 hours is generally a pathology in our society. It's hard to hold a job when you're sleeping 12 hours of every 24 hour. And we would call that idiopathic hypersomnia. So I'd recommend you talk to your personal physician, nurse practitioner, and see if a repeat study with that CPAP on needs to be done, followed by what we call a multiple sleep latency test to see if, despite successful therapy with sleep apnea, he is still sleeping 12 hours per day. Because correct me if I'm wrong, if he is trying to work a full-time job, wouldn't that be difficult to do if he was sleeping 12 hours a day?
Yeah. Okay.
And get anything done. Okay, thank you.
Okay, good luck.
KP in Des Moines, thank you very much. KP dialed 1-866-780-9100. 780-9100. Got the three or so minutes before we go to break, Dr. Daikin. Follow up on this. This was a study. It ties in with what you just said, this new study finding that our personal sleep requirements, and you said normal, that bell-shaped curve, you say, may range anywhere from 4 hours of sleep. You feel great. The rest, I mean, lucky you, you get about 20 hours of waking life, way over to what is the top and of normal without a sleep pathology, 10 hours?
Yeah, a little less than 10. You'd like to be, you know, 9 point. right. But if you start sleeping more than 10 to 11 hours in a 24-hour period, it really interferes with function in our society.
Mm-hmm. And this study tied it to DNA. So
yeah.
That, I mean, something we've long thought is the case, that just like the size of your nose and the color of your eyes and the gait of when you walk down the street, that it's all tied into your DNA.
Yeah, and in fact, what they did is they took fruit flies. My wife used to do research on fruit flies. You know, they're easy to do. They have sleep-wake cycle. And
they actually sleep.
Yeah, yeah. Most things
when they're
have
around my bananas, they seem to never sleep. They just are constantly
a stimulus control kind of a thing. They're excited. So get rid of those bananas. Be that as it may, they bred short sleeping flies and long sleeping flies, and then compared the flies' genetic makeup. So the long sleepers slept 18 hours over a 24-hour day, and the short only 3 hours. And they found that there were 126 differences across 80 different genes. So, you know, it's sort of no big surprise, but there is the feats of the bell-shaped curve. Some people need only five. Some people start needing more.
Okay, just like any all this, the genetic blueprints of our bodies as we get them figured out more and more. So it could be in the future that early on in life you would have your genetic makeup read, and then you would know for your lifetime what is an optimal length of sleep?
Yeah, and you know, and in fact, there are questionnaires that parallel this, where you might not be best for a job where you need to be up 24 hours a day if you have that tendency to be a sleepy person who needs 12 or more hours per day. So, and then you sort of worry about whose business is that? Because I would like to be, you know, a person who works with emergency medicine crew, and maybe they'll limit what I can do. So the future holds a lot of things, and I think genetics may actually be able to give you that kind of a blueprint someday.
Okay, Dr. Eric Daikin is with us. We have to go away, put this conversation in a short sleep state for a few minutes before we come back.
Hibernation.
A little hibernation. Dr. Eric Daikin, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Program at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We'd sure love to have you share your sleep problem or unusual sleep experience or sleep remedy that you've worked out yourself. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll talk about a nap deprivation study. Do you like naps? What if you were deprived of your naps? How would it affect your mental performance? We have a study on that when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Turned on the light, I pulled down the shade, went to the kitchen for a bite. Rolled up the shade, turned off the light. Jump back into bed, it was the middle of the night. The clock downstairs was striking four. Couldn't get you off my mind. I heard the milkman at the door.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, catching up on our sleep news and research. So glad to have Dr. Eric Daikin with us, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Also looking to you. How is your sleep? Share your sleep problem, your unusual sleep experience this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Number of emails here, Dr. Daikin. We'll clip right along here. We have some other research to get to. Nap deprivation study that we want to have you talk about in just a moment. But let's first go to our phones. Terry dialed 1-866-780-9100. Terry in Davenport. How are you today, Terry?
Oh, good. Thank you.
Have you got a problem to share, or what are your thoughts on sleep?
No, I have a question for
for the doctor. I've been told that, and actually kind of practiced the idea that singing kind of strengthens your throat muscles, and is very good at kind of curing snoring problems. And I think the resulting, you know, problems people have sleeping when they snore.
And
any comment on that?
And you said
old wives' tale,
right? With Terry, you said you've practiced this. You've been singing in order to perhaps sleep better.
Well, it was more of a killer, like a lot of people. You'll drive down the road and you sing in the car. You're kind of a private singer.
Okay,
but I'm pretty enthusiastic about it, and I don't snore.
Okay.
Which is unusual, it seems like, and I've recommended it to other people, and I've heard reports of it, and that it was kind of a put two and two together, and I was wondering if it was just a wives' tale or if there was any science that went along with that.
Okay, Terry and Davenport, what an interesting question.
Well, there's a lot of reasons to have sleep apnea. It can be an anatomic problem. It could be a central problem from a stroke. It could be kissing tonsils. It could be weak vocal cords, the glottis, if you will, and those are muscles. So I've had lesions. They didn't know what the heck they were, thought they were cancer initially, but they didn't grow. We still don't know what they are, but I had vocal rehab, and I still use vocal rehab. So I've got at that level, right above, you know, where the vocal cords are, right below is my airway that goes to my lungs. If those are weak, if they're not working, they collapse and you get no air in your lungs. And that is a different kind of obstructive apnea. So I've had people with stroke or injuries that have related to vocal cord paralysis or partial. So in those cases, singing is a wonderful exercise. And there are a variety of different techniques you can use in that regard. And in fact, it does bleed over into the didgeridoo. So that is, you know, that big horn thing that they play in Australia. And there have been studies on this that you're utilizing upper airway musculature, at much like you might be in singing. And it might reduce, in some of these studies, traditional use of this practice, et cetera, a decrease in your apnea hypopnea index. Now, it may not cure everything, but in any given individual, and again, with some of my people with vocal cord weakness, I've been almost religious in recommending they continue speech therapy. So good for you. Keep singing.
Yeah, Terry, very good. So good. Thanks for that question about a wives' tale. Do you have a favorite line you sing in private that you'd like to put public at this moment?
You can make millions.
maybe sometime when I'm in the car. Thank you.
All right. Terry's shy about that. He's going to be a big star someday, we think.
Yeah, real big, yeah. Thank you.
Terry at Davenport, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about this nap deprivation study. A new study examining how napping affects mental performance from the Journal of Sleep Research. So describe it. Help me describe this. These are habitual nappers, people who love naps. And what did they do to these people?
Well, they separated them into groups where they didn't let them get that nap. And they, prior to the sleep or nap deprivation, they gave them a series of cognitive performance tasks of variable difficulty. And they found that if you take a person who routinely gets their midday nap, the siesta, if you will, and a lot of people in the world, genetically, if you will, we're on that swing today, really prefer it. That's what they choose. They do worse. And especially on the more difficult tasks. Doesn't mean they can't function. So depending on what you're going to do, it may be a variable issue. But it really didn't affect their mood much. Sleep deprivation may even help some people's mood for a while. But again, it almost shows the obvious. If you're used to a nap, you're sleep deprived, so to speak, you may perform worse on more difficult tasks.
Okay. Dr. Eric Dykin with us. Join us with your sleep question, your sleep problem, 1-866-780-9100. We do have a lot of input. We want to get through some of these questions that people are sharing in Des Moines. DJ is with us. Hi, DJ.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to the program. Have you got a sleep problem to share? Question?
Well, I have used a sleep apnea machine for a CPAP machine for over 10 years, and I bought a new one about a year ago, but then I had it repeat sleep study, and I got upgraded to a BiPAP machine. So I have this very lightly used, rather expensive machine, and I'd like to know what I should do with it. I'd like to help somebody.
Oh, okay. So a pretty new CPAP machine. BiPAP machine, what's the difference there between BiPAP and CPAP?
Bi-level PAP is a machine that senses when you breathe in and when you breathe out. And because of the physiology and the anatomy of sleep apnea, Dr. Sanders out in Pittsburgh, good buddy of ours, showed this many years ago, you generally need a higher pressure when you breathe in. It's like swimming with a riptide. Doesn't bother you as much. And a lower pressure, more comfortable, when you breathe out, by the way. A lot of people can get by with a jalopy, CPAP, you know, someone like me. But a lot of people really do better with a bi-level PAP. So it's a more comfortable machine. And as is implied, I had a good friend. She passed away many years ago. And Don, he's retired now, but my technologist, he had a way to funnel the old machines to indigent people. So you can ask your doctor or the sleep clinics that you follow up with, if, or even your durable medical equipment company, you know, where you get the machine, if they know of these donation services, because there are people who just don't have the money to be able to afford this, their insurance, the copay. I got to tell you, my copay is pretty high, and wouldn't that be a nice Christmas present? Okay. So you might even check with calling the sleep lab if you can't find anyone else, because I'm sure we can find somebody we could donate this machine to, and they'd love you for it.
Okay, DJ, good luck. Good luck with that new BiPAP machine. Thanks for calling in and for thinking of others as well. Okay, let's go to Cecilia in Davenport. Hi, Cecilia. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm calling because it was recommended that I get a sleep study when I saw my general practitioner at my last appointment. And in calling and talking with them to set that up, I found out that the results would go back to my general practitioner. Now, my question is it, I could self-refer and just go directly to the sleep clinic and then talk with one of the two specialists there. One's been doing it for maybe 19 years and the other just a year or so. One's a neurologist and maybe a cardiologist perhaps by training. Would it be preferable to just talk directly with the doctors at the sleep clinic as compared to doing it with my family practitioner?
And it's all the environment that you live in. And the backbone of medicine in the United States is the general practitioner, the MA, the PA, the local ARNP. They are really the backbone. And how often do you need to see the super specialists? So one of the thoughts that we're seeing today, there are seven subspecialties of medicine: internal medicine, psychiatry, neurology, pediatrics, otolaryngology, anesthesiology, family medicine. All have to show training in basic sleep medicine, which includes obstructive apnea and what you're talking about right now. So the fund of knowledge is there. It's just, where's the lab? And sometimes some people have a continuity of care, if you will. The individual who's going to read my sleep study is the one who scheduled it. You know, eventually you'll probably follow up like in our lab. We allow a lot of our colleagues to do a direct referral to the lab, and then we follow them up and give them the straight poop. And it's relatively unusual, but not rare, that they'll say, oh, I didn't know about that. Well, thank you very much, because this is all we do. So the super specialist, you don't always have to see, but it is part of the basic training of almost any general practitioner that you'll meet.
Okay, Cecilia in Davenport, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Let's go to an email. This is from Sherry. Sherry writes, I have a niece that cannot wake up easily, may sleep 36 hours, and it's impossible to wake her. She has been to many doctors and is 44 years old, does not have sleep apnea. She has a computer job from home, which includes overseas contacts, so is able to work. She is very intelligent. This has held her back. Is there anything new on this problem? Okay, 36 hours. So this is definitely a pathology, we can say. And what can you tell us about the case of Sherry's niece? Yeah, Dr. Dyke.
Yeah, well, you know, if this was a youngster and in the early 20s, teens, more likely a male who seemed a little bit hungry and ate a lot and slept long, long periods of time, and then it resolved after a few weeks, we'd call this Klein-Levin syndrome. And it can recur over a 1 to 2 year period, but the people usually recover completely. They have these long periods of hypersomnolence, whether it's a subclinical viral infection and encephalitis. We really don't know what it is, but that's not her. She's 44 years old. And then 36 hours. Now, then the question is this a lifelong problem? And, you know, you'd like to see the sleep diary and exactly were there any naps involved, and if this prolonged 36 hours, et cetera, is this idiopathic hypersomnia where people generally sleep over 10 to 12 hours per day? So, as you've implied, people have seen her. And as you've implied, you don't have a diagnosis. But what I would do is, again, make sure she sees her general practitioner, that ARNP, MAPA doctor, whoever it is. If this is this severe, this might be a case for a referral to a specialist in sleep medicine, possibly an overnight sleep study with a daytime sleepiness study to see what may be going on. Because, yes, you're sleeping 36 hours straight. That's concerning in this society. It's hard to hold a job.
Okay, Dr. Eric Dyken is with us. If you just joined us, we're coming to the end of the hour. We like to do this several times a year, catching up on our sleep news and research, a little bit of research that Dr. Dyken commenting on, and also answering your questions. Incidentally, the man who called up wanting to donate his rather new CPAP machine because he got changed to a different machine, a caller just called it suggesting contacting the Iowa City Free Medical Clinic to donate an old CPAP machine. It's a nonprofit organization, so I'll pass that along. Let's go to another email. This is from this one is from Terry. Tara, excuse me. I use a sleep app on my phone. Boy, aren't those all the trend? Sleep apps on phone at night, writes Tara, to track my sleep quality. It's called Sleep Cycle. It calculates the percentage. Do you know what apps use to calculate the quality? Do I want or need more time in deep sleep or a good combo of both? So having spoken with you before about sleep apps, there are all kinds out there because we have, 60, 70 million people with chronic sleep problems.
Bunches and bunches.
If you could just download something from the Play Store or the Apple Store that would help your sleep and track your sleep, they measure movement in bed. Movement,
yeah.
and really don't do what you do in a sleep study.
Yeah, and nothing wrong with that. In fact, the expensive form of that is the actigraphy, and that's used traditionally. And boy, it's an important thing for us all to know as sleep experts how to read the results from an actigraph because it gives you a general idea when you're awake and there's sleep. And we often look at people with chronic or long-term insomnia once we've ruled out sleep apnea, their sleep-related problems, on the consistency of their sleep for circadian rhythm problems, for insomnia problems. So they sort of parallel that. And one of the thoughts is just ask yourself, patient, know thyself. Do you feel good after you get to sleep at night? And I don't need a machine. I got to tell you, I never use them myself because I know if I've got a good night of sleep.
Let me jump in here. Yeah. Before we have about 5 minutes left of our show. We wanted to mention this. This is the headline here. This cuddly robot is designed to lull you to sleep. Let me just read a little bit of this is from mentalfloss.com. For people seeking all the benefits of a human sleeping companion without the human part, there's a new Kickstarter-backed product, Somnox, the self-proclaimed world's first sleep robot, designed to give you a more comfortable, energizing night's sleep. It's a bean-shaped cushion that is perfect in size, it says, and shape for cuddling you as you drift to sleep. I guess it makes breathing sounds. It can sync up with your own breathing. It's a steep price tag. You needed to pledge over $500 to get in on this Kickstarter background. But even so, the campaign surpassed its fundraising goal. So you may see Somnox, the world's first sleep robot there. What did you make of this new product that people sleeping with robots?
Well, you know, sleep's all the rage right now, and there's a lot of products, as we've talked about, that are out there. You know, I saw a picture of the thing, and, you know, I have such bad arthritis and things. I've got body pillows and all these other things that really work for me. So I envisioned the body pillow when I saw this. But when they talked about the sleep, breathing, respiratory pattern, I guess it actually monitors that, and then it may entrain you to keep a regular sleep pattern. And it's sort of interesting. Central apnea, where people go to sleep and they just stop breathing. We know that CPAP, continuous positive pressure, that stimulation of a mask over the face, which may also help you retain some of your CO2, whatever, yeah, that might also help entrain a rhythm in breathing. So I thought it was sort of cute, sort of interesting, and maybe it does. I don't know. You know, if someone gave me one for free, I'd probably try it.
Right. It may be also, you know, people sleep next to their dogs, too. You could get in sync with your dog's breath.
Yeah, I prefer my wife. But, I mean, what works for the individual works for the individual. And it looks like they put some thought into this thing.
Right. Okay. Let's go to Nancy in Iowa City. Not much time, Nancy. I'll ask you to be brief, but we're glad you gave us a ring. What's up?
Thanks. I have a relative who's 35 years old in the tech industry, and he tends to go hard at his work and not sleep for long periods of time and then try to recover by sleeping for too long. And I just wondered how deleterious that is to his long-term health.
So we know that people who sleep less than 5 hours per night on average are at higher risk for cardiovascular, cerebrovascular disease, hypertension. Number one cause of death in the world, heart attack. Number two cause of death in the world, ischemic stroke, all often related to hypertension. So the lack of sleep tends to increase inflammatory elements in your system, and those inflammatory elements affect your blood vessels, they affect your heart, they affect morbidity and mortality. Routine sleep, 7 to 9 hours of sleep, is really what you want to get. So it's not good to fool Mother Nature.
To deprive your husband, it's not good, Nancy, I guess, for your husband to deprive himself of sleep. But, I mean, you got to do what you got to do to earn a living, right?
Short term, solidify the job. I got to tell you, pot calling the kettle black. Medical school and residency almost killed me, but now I'm an old man and they let me sleep.
Okay, Nancy, that's a relative, not your husband. Forgive me for that. But anyway.
That's okay. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in. Nancy in Iowa City will be our last caller because I want to ask you about a couple of other things very quickly. What did I want? Oh, sleep studies. Tuck, this is a non-commercial organization dedicated to health, from what I could tell, recently evaluated the best and worst cities for sleep. Now, Iowa does not have any of the top cities for best, but in Iowa looks relatively good for sleep.
Yeah, Des Moines wasn't bad.
Yeah. Well, did you have the data right there?
No, I took a sap because I can't sleep anywhere else but Iowa. So it works for me.
That's a problem if you want to go to a conference somewhere. So the best, do those make sense to you? Colorado Springs, Sioux Falls, Boise, Portland, Oregon, Lincoln, Nebraska. Does it make sense? The criteria they're using here, they've got about a half dozen: sleep deprivation, obesity rates, unemployment rate, commute time, air quality, light pollution, ongoing construction. I mean, you could pull a lot of different variables. They happen to pick those.
Yeah, and I guess they're common sense variables, but, you know, like the commute time. I live out on a farm, so it's 30 minutes coming in. I do my vocal rehab coming in, and I'm happy on my commute. So they looked at things that were common sense, put them all together, and then they came up with this, standards. It's interesting to read.
The worst places to sleep, according to this study. What do we have there, Doctor?
It's Detroit, they say. But, you know, they had some good rock and roll. And so, I mean,
Newark, Birmingham. Birmingham.
Cleveland is the home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean,
Philadelphia. So all big cities. City ongoing construction, low. Light pollution, air quality. You've got all those things there, right?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, they looked at things that can relate to sleep-related problems, added them all up, and they came out with these lists. So God knows how it really translates down to each individual. But it was fun to read.
Okay. Dr. Daikin, we have just over a minute left. Winter solstice happens this Thursday. The shortest day of the year. We have the least amount of sunshine on one day here. In Iowa, that means anywhere from just under 9 hours of daylight to about 9 hours, 15 minutes, depending on where you are, north, south in Iowa. Since our brains, our biological clocks, therefore our sleep depends on sunlight, give us some quick tips on the dealing with the shortest days of the year. And I'm giving you less than a minute.
Well, you know, and it's really interesting because my present sleep fellow is already doing this. So seasonal affective disorder, it affects to some degree almost 25% of the people in the New York area. That's where they did a study because of the reduced effects of sunlight on the overall happiness and well-being of the body. So sometimes you can use a bright light therapy, and that's what she's using.
Or when you have a nice sunny day, dash out there if your job
Take
allows.
A walk.
Get out there, get some sunlight in the morning light,
yeah.
And evening light, important, right?
Yeah, late afternoon, early afternoon, 50,000 lux of stimulation to the brain.
Well, I wish you lots of lux. That was a bad joke.
That was so sweet. Thank you very much.
Dr. Eric Daikin, catching up on our sleep news and research. Ben Stanton, our producer, with Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. I just can't go sleep.